The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to be here. Catherine Coleman Flowers is a hero of the environmental justice movement. For 20 years, she's worked to shed light on the gaps in access to basic sanitation in rural America. In addition to being a founding director of the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice, she is also a senior fellow for the Center for Earth Ethics at Union Theological Seminary and a member of the National Resources Defense Council. In 2020, she was named a MacArthur Fellow. Her new book, Waste, One Woman's Fight Against America's Dirty Secret, charts the inspiring story of the evolution of her activism. This evening, she'll be joined in conversation with Kalia Ali Wertheimer, fashion designer, author, and supporter of numerous humanitarian efforts. Her many honors include the National Congressional Award for Public Service. And now the screen is all yours.
Thank you so much. I want to preface this by saying what an honor to sit in a position of being on the other side of Catherine Coleman Flowers. I am also so humbled deeply to call her a friend. As you may or may not be aware, my father was or is the late boxer Muhammad Ali, and I have been very privileged to meet extraordinary human beings in my life. Catherine stands out uniquely as one of the most resilient, beautiful, incredible forces that I've ever seen in this world. So Catherine, I want to start with your childhood, how you were an activist at a very, very young age and also served our country. In addition to the, you know, just starting from where you started in life, what about your childhood or your upbringing makes a contribution to who you are today?
Well, thank you. Well, first of all, both of you for the sentiments that you express. This is a pleasure for me to be here and to be able to share this platform with you, who my friend, and also to be able to talk about this journey. One of the things that Kalia did not tell the audience is that she sits on the board for the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice. Well, I have, I think one of the reasons that I've been able to do this work, one of the things that inspired me were my parents who were activists. In our household, they were the ones that the local people in the community would come to whenever there was a problem and that needed to be solved. They all worked with certain folk for the purpose of trying to bring about justice, because this was, you know, in the late 1960s when a lot of things were going on, and this was like shortly after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, and it led to a lot of barriers had to be brought down, and they were part of bringing those barriers down. The other thing that was very inspiring to me, and I haven't told this story publicly before, but there were people that I would see on television sometimes that were inspiring to me. And one of those people was Muhammad Ali. I used to stay up. I remember being a kid, 9 and 10 years of age, staying up to watch the Tonight Show. I mean, I'm dating myself because a lot of people on here probably don't even know about the Tonight Show, but I would watch the Tonight Show, and sometimes he and Howard Cosell would always be on there together, and then he would say poetry, and that was all inspiring to me. Actually, I started writing poetry, and I guess the rhythm pattern that he used was the rhythm pattern that I initially used, but it was all of those inspirational things that happened. And there were people like John Jackson, who became the first mayor of Whitehall, Alabama. And he was one of my inspirations too. And John, like Muhammad Ali, because of what was going on in America at the time, did not go to Vietnam. And they were and your father came to his aid and helped him. John was a very young man who's still an advisor to me and kind of stand shoulder to shoulder with me in dealing with this sanitation issue in Lowndes County, even when it wasn't popular. So I'm inspired by a lot of people like that. And even when I met John, was around the same time that I was in awe of the poetry and the things that your father stood for at that time. So this is indeed an honor for me to be here, not just because of the book itself, but because of the inspiration that I have gotten through the years. And I've never said this publicly, but I want to thank you, because I can't thank your father right now, but because of that, I think that this is one of the reasons why I'm where I am, and that's part of my inspiration.
Catherine, he's definitely smiling from above on that note. And you know, the one common thread that I see that bonds the both of you together is that you're an unapologetic force of nature, even putting your life on the line, both of you, which makes you an extraordinary hero for so many reasons, and for that one, for so much more. I think one of the other things, which leads me to my next question, that I find extraordinary about you in such a polarized political climate is that you have managed to bridge the divide. You're able to work with both sides of the aisle to cause change. Could you talk a little more to that?
Yes. One of the things that I describe in the book was my relationship and is my relationship with Bob Woodson. And Bob Woodson, he characterized himself as a Jack Kemp Republican. And I met Bob Woodson many years ago now. The first time I met him at Stillman College, he was there for a 21st Century Youth Leadership event. And I remember it was a contentious exchange that took place because I had matured to the point where at the point where I could have a discussion with somebody that I had differences with. I was very young and I was there with my students. So the next time I saw him, Mr. Woodson was speaking at a faith-based summit, and I happened to be there, and I approached him and asked him to help me with Lowndes County, which he did. And I think that in the book, I described that whole era when we were fighting, we first learned about the wastewater problem and the things that we tried to do to address it at that particular time and employing some of the things that some of the paradigms that people were telling us to use at that time. But we then found out it was a greater problem. And one of the reasons that Bob Woodson is also significant is because he's from Philadelphia. So he's from Philadelphia, and I met him in Washington. He resides in Washington now, but he's a native of Philadelphia. The other person that I also worked with was Jeff Sessions. A lot of people, this is the side of Jeff Sessions that I guess people don't know, but I met him I actually met Jeff Sessions at a town hall meeting. I was the economic development coordinator for Lowndes County, and I attended a town hall meeting where town hall meetings are where senators actually go into rural communities to present about what they're doing on Capitol Hill. And he was there, and he talked about some of the programs that he thought could benefit Lowndes County. And I asked him, well, how can Lowndes County get access to these programs? They're grants and they require a match. And this is a place without a tax base. So how do poor people get access to these programs? He could answer my question. So he came to me later at that town hall meeting and said, you know, I've always been concerned about that and I don't know what to do. And we talked about it. He told me that he was from Wilcox County, Alabama, which is part of the Black Belt, and how he had grown up without a television in the house until he got to a certain age. So we formed an alliance. And initially, when people were being arrested for not having septic systems, one of the persons who always sent people to meetings with me because I was getting death threats was Jeff Sessions.
Right.
At that time was Senator Sessions.
Well, you know, you have so many significant relationships. I mean, on an average day when I speak to you, you've either just circled off the phone with Cory Booker or Bernie Sanders or Al Gore. But there's one person in particular that really stands out to me, and it's your relationship with Jane Fonda. Mm-hmm.
And you're participating not only, you know, together in our foundation, but also a lot of her endeavors like Fire Drill Friday. Any more you want to share with us about that? I know it's a really special relationship.
Yes, it's interesting how I met Jane, and I talk about it in the book. I actually met Jane through Kat Taylor. Kat Taylor is Tom Steyer's wife. And Kat and I met as a result. I work for the Equal Justice Initiative, and we were getting ready to launch.
We should check. That's Brian Stevenson.
Brian Stevenson, who wrote the foreword for the book. So we were getting ready to open the National Memorial to Peace and Justice, which is the first ever memorial in the country to acknowledge the victims of lynching. And one of the students there, one of the interns there, he told me one day, he said, you know, Catherine, there's somebody you should meet because I think you have a lot in common. And that's how I ended up meeting Kat Taylor. He connected us by text message. And then Kat and I developed a friendship. And one day she said, have you ever met Jane Fonda? I said, no, I haven't. So she was telling me about this place called Allensworth, and I talk about Allensworth in the book. Allensworth is located in the Central Valley in California and has a water problem and a wastewater problem. And it's like a good example of climate change, but also environmental justice issues there, because Allensworth was the first town in California that was founded by Black people and paid for by Black people. And we decided to go to Allensworth. And so I met Jane when she came to town, and she and I and Kat got together, and we actually took a road trip. And we went to Allensworth. And that was very interesting. One of the stories I think I tell in the book there too that I want to share. One is that we had to stop on the way to Allensworth. We were driving from Palo Alto to Allensworth. So in driving, we had to stop to use the bathroom. That was a long trip. So we stopped to use the bathroom. And it was like this restroom out in the middle of nowhere. You know, at a service station. It was on the outside. So, you know, my experience has taught me, you don't want to go to a bathroom that's on the outside, not inside the service station. But anyway, here we were all standing in line. Nobody would have known that this was Jane Fonda and Kat Taylor standing in line to go to this bathroom. But that was how, that was kind of how we forged our relationship. And then we were talking and I was telling her that I was starting the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice and asked her to join the board, and she agreed. So when we launched it in October of 2017, she actually came to Lowndes County, and of course you were with us. And one of the other things that happened while she was there is that we went to a local restaurant after we had gone to visit families in Lowndes County. And they didn't expect me to bring this large crowd because we had not called ahead. But when we got there, they had to prepare food for us. So we were all sitting there chatting at our tables. And then Jane disappears. And then the next thing we noticed, she's coming out with everybody's drink. She's serving drinks, and then she's serving food. It's like, oh my God, this is a phenomenal woman. And so it was, people didn't know. And then of course, Kat was joining her doing it too. And nobody knew that here it was the wife of Tom Steyer, who in her own right is a banker. And they're both serving food to those of us that came. And that kind of reminds me of the humbleness of both of them. And they have been very much a support of the work that I'm doing. And part of documenting this, I had to tell those stories because it's those kind of relationships, I think, that have helped us to be successful and will help us to be even more successful in the future.
Well, you know, Catherine, speaking of success, you've overcome so many adversities and have overturned the impossible time and time again, looking back or maybe even looking forward. What would you consider your greatest victory to be or anticipated to be in the future?
You know, I would like to, first of all, I'll answer that question in two parts. One, I think the greatest victories have been those young people that I've worked with. Mm-hmm. more recently, one of the young people is was a student at Duke that I met, and he was trying to determine what his role was going to be as an engineer. And he came to visit and spend some time in Lowndes County for the purpose of doing some research as he was working on his dissertation. And he asked me to serve on his dissertation committee. And one of the proudest moments for me was when he defended his dissertation talking about environmental justice in engineering. And actually went in at the, he was nervous about that because he wasn't sure how, you know, people would respond and so forth. But at the end of the day, everyone was very, very impressed. And he talked about part of his presentation, his dissertation talked about his work in Lowndes County. And I think if I had to have examples of success, it would be those young people that we've worked with that see the value of environmental justice, have made it part of their lives and their commitment to the work world is to make sure that we do something about these issues. And then, of course, the second part of that is to be able to envision what wastewater equality looks like, what sanitation mm-hmm. equality looks like. When we first started talking about waste, and especially raw sewage, a lot of people weren't interested in it. We couldn't get the media to cover it, anything. And we have, and now here, we're at a point where there's a book that people are very interested in. They have defied all the things that I was told by the naysayers about this issue, and people wouldn't be interested. And the fact that we're talking about rural communities now, you know, when people uh-huh. talk about problems and infrastructure, they're generally talking about urban areas. I don't think that we should not talk about urban areas, but we should not leave rural communities behind. And now we're having those discussions. So I think maybe hopefully the next book can be about the innovation that we're in, that we can inspire to happen, where we can treat wastewater to the point where it's clean when it comes out of those pipes, if it goes through a pipe, or we can use some of the technologies that they use in outer space and bring it down to earth, where we can use it in a home and just redo the way we look at wastewater, because we have to look at it within the context of climate change.
You know, Catherine, I also want to add that you do have a history of serving people in so many ways. You're a mother, you're a grandmother, you've served our country in the Army, and also as a school teacher as well, which is really significant. When you were mentioning the young men's dissertation, that definitely came to mind. You know, you're certainly not unfamiliar to challenges. And I think all of us listening, and we're here because we care, you know, sometimes feel that the problem is so large. You know, where can I begin? What can I do? What can I do now? What's tangible? What would you tell everyone listening that they could do to become an activist or to participate in change?
Well, I think that you have to find a problem that needs to be solved. I think that we also have to listen more. Just to give an example, when you and I went to Cancer Alley, Cancer Alley is a place that's primarily between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, where there are a lot of petrochemical plants, multinational petrochemical plants, and the people that live in those areas have a lot of cancer as a result. And when we went there, we were escorted by General Russell Honoré. And I think I'll tell that story in the book. But when we went there, one of the things that we were able to learn is we had to listen to the local people tell their stories. And we have to, so I think number one, we have to listen, because listening is a part of activism. We can't find solutions if we go in thinking we know the answers and we haven't listened to the people that's living with the problem. I think the second thing that we can do as it relates to waste and this issue is they took the question off the census in 1990 that helped us to understand how many people are on-site septic systems. And it's more than we know. And I'm sure even there in Pennsylvania, there are a lot of people on septic systems. So it would be helpful we're going to ultimately put up a website for on put up a question on our website, the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice, where we're going to be asking people around the country to help us identify areas where they're having wastewater problems, because the only way we're going to have real sustainable solutions is that we have to help the policymakers know how extreme these problems are and where they are located. Because right now, if people think they can go and put in 50 septic systems in Lowndes County, the problem is solved, and that's not true. So we have to help people to understand how widespread this problem is.
And, Catherine, mm-hmm. can you give us a couple of websites, links, your Instagram handle, so people can get researching?
Yes, I'm Catherine C. Flowers on Instagram. I'm Kath Flowers at Twitter, and I am Catherine Coleman Flowers on Facebook. And I also have a Facebook public figure page as well. It just says Catherine Coleman Flowers, public figure. So if all of those places, and the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice has a website, and we also have a Facebook page that's available for CREACH as well, and people want to write me there, I get those messages too. So I'm easy to access. I mean, I've been getting, especially since we've been getting a lot of national attention, I've been getting emails and messages from around the country, the people that are supporting us or want to be a part of it. But your issue, whoever you are that's watching, it doesn't have to be about waste. But if there's an issue there that you think that you should be a part, that you want to help to solve, I think that the thing to do is listen. If it's not in your community, now if it's in your community, start documenting what the issues are, and then also propose policy solutions, because I think sometimes the best proposals are coming from the grassroots and not from the top down.
Catherine, what's next? You know, the book has been a huge success. Foundation is up and running. You have your hands stirring in so many pots to make the world a better place. But what's next? What's on the horizon for you?
I would love to continue to teach. I would love to continue to teach. I would love it if young people around the country would read the book, and colleges and universities would have book clubs, and I would go and speak to the students and help to understand my journey, because my goal is to inspire. Because the way to, you know, I believe in the seventh generation principle, which I've adopted from my indigenous brothers and sisters, which is whatever we do, we have to do it to benefit seven generations to come. And I think the best way to have transformational leadership or to be a servant leader is to prepare other people to take your place. And that's what's next for me.
And so everyone who's listening can start thinking about preparing their questions, because we're going to open up Q&A in a few minutes. And we'll get ready to wrap things up, because I could talk to you forever, as I do and enjoy doing. A lot of this comes down to legacy. It's something that I relate to and means so much to me. You know, I figure that our work together is part of me helping to preserve and cultivate my father's legacy. I have this sense of custodial rights over it that way, you know, internally, just a strong feeling. I'm so privileged and pleased to work with you to help to curate my father's legacy. What about yours? You know, what do you want to be your legacy someday?
I would like for my legacy to be that when I saw a problem, I tried to help, you know, and I did it out of love. Mm. Oftentimes you know, people help because they, for other reasons, but I've done it out of love. And if it wasn't for Lowndes County, I probably wouldn't even be doing what I'm doing right now. And I love the people of Lowndes County. And I've come to have an appreciation for my rural roots. And I like for people to understand rural communities a whole lot better than they do now. And out of that, I am developing, which may end up being my next subject that I write about, but helping people to understand the complexities of rural communities so that they won't come in with an urban perspective and add to the problem instead of trying to solve the problem, because they don't understand how rural people are, and they don't understand, like when people ask me the question, well, why don't they just connect to a municipal system? We're talking about unincorporated communities, but a lot of people don't understand that. So my legacy, I believe, would be to make sure that we don't leave rural communities out of the conversation when we talk about infrastructure, when we talk about a Green New Deal, when we talk about economic development, that we have to include rural communities as well.
That's so incredible. I'm sure there are a lot of questions, and this was the time prescribed for me to throw it back over to the Philadelphia Public Library.
Thank you.
Catherine, thank you. It was awesome.
Thank you both so much. It is my pleasure to be back and to moderate the Q&A. Catherine, just to start off, what has been the impact of COVID on waste?
Oh, wow. Well, one of the things that we've seen in the community that I write about, Lowndes County, Alabama, has had the highest per capita death and infection rates in the state of Alabama. And I wonder how much of that is related to raw sewage, people being exposed to it, because clearly their systems, they can't be as healthy or as strong as they should be if they're exposed to raw sewage coming back into their homes. We have found, one of the engineers I've worked with has just told me that in testing COVID, that they can actually, testing for COVID in a community, they can test the raw sewage, the sewage in a community, to determine 2 to 3 weeks in advance where the outbreaks are going to be before people start showing up for tests. So, so I believe that could be a vulnerability that we have not considered that happens in places where people don't have proper infrastructure. Then if you look at Navajo Nation, where they've had a high death rate as well and a high infection rate, and a lot of that in Navajo Nation, there is no infrastructure in a lot of those communities, a lot of homes. They have no water infrastructure, and they have certainly no wastewater infrastructure. And one of the things that we're asked to do to protect ourselves from COVID is to wash our hands. So I believe that COVID itself has magnified the inequalities that exist in rural and urban communities. And a lot of the deaths that we're seeing now, like in South Dakota, I just read that they're having like 1 out of 8 people in South Dakota have died from COVID. So we have to, there's a relationship between the lack of access to proper water and sanitation and the kinds of health issues that have manifested, and COVID has made it worse.
Do you mind if I quick jump back in and interject? Because I think this is a good time now to talk about Pamela, because it is the marriage of COVID and your profound work in Lowndes County, and also a very tragic story, but I think one that we can learn a lot from.
Well, yes, Pamela, and I wrote an epilogue to her, and I talk about her in the book as well. So Pamela Rush worked with us. She worked with the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice, but we're actually distant cousins, but I did know Pamela. One of her sisters got in touch with me and asked me to go and meet Pamela because she felt that I could potentially help her. And when I went to talk with Pamela, I saw that Pamela was trapped in a predatory loan situation with a mobile home that her mother and brother had owned, and the home was in serious disrepair. It was like, to me, the greatest example of what happened in communities where there's climate change issues because of extreme heat, and you could see the mold and the mildew outside and inside the home. And there were other things that were there, but Pamela ended up becoming like a Fannie Lou Hamer of poverty. Reverend William Barber, who is the founder of the New Poor People's Campaign, went to visit her and invited her to Washington to speak. And when she went to Washington, there were senators like Senator Cory Booker and Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Elizabeth Warren and others that were there to actually heard her testimony about living in poverty.
I think it's important to say, Catherine, you actually bought them there, which I thought was extraordinary.
Yeah, and later
they came there because of you.
Yeah, and later Senator Sanders and even Jane Fonda came to actually see firsthand the situation that Pamela was living in. But we were trying to relocate Pamela from where she was, but COVID interceded. And on January the 3rd, at the age of 50, she had just turned 50, Pamela died from COVID. And she left two children, and her children are ages 18 and 13. And but it's just a sad situation, and it's kind of represents what we've seen in Lowndes County. I had another relative to die from COVID. Actually, it was a father. The father died first, and then his daughter died. But that's because that's at the intersection of, for a lot of people, is at the intersection of poverty and climate change. And then you add these environmental justice issues, so many different layers. And hopefully one of the things that we can do is work to dismantle all of these. And I think that that's part of Pamela's legacy, is that people are paying attention. And the excerpt from about Pamela's story, the epilogue, was actually published in the New York Times. And I'm still getting responses from people who read it and were moved by it.
Thank you so much, Catherine. I'm going to move to a question from one of our listeners tonight. It says, great talk. Thank you. How are rural communities actually fighting to fix the wastewater issue? And are there instances in the north, west, and middle of the country? Have there been successes in the fight? If so, have those successes been duplicated?
Well, first of all, the wastewater issue is all over the country. I've actually heard from people right there in Pennsylvania that got wastewater problems. So that's the first thing. That's why it's America's dirty secret, because a lot of people don't know how widespread it is. And second, a lot of rural communities, I think people expect the communities to come up with the money to fix it. Well, I'm sure Philadelphia's money, their wastewater system was built with public monies. And in communities that are small communities and don't have the money to actually put in place the type of expensive systems that are less likely to fail, what do they do? Do we ignore them? If it's an individual who's poor like Pamela, who couldn't even afford decent housing, what do we do? Do we just leave them to their own devices? And the other issue is a lot of these systems simply do not work. That's why in the book I talk about the need for us to have a wastewater innovation and find systems that do work. And we can't count out climate change. How does climate change factor into this? Well, a lot of these septic systems are in the ground. And they're in the ground, like in Lowndes County, the ground holds water. When we tried to put in a septic system for Pamela, we were told that the engineers, when they did the engineering work, first of all, they went down 25 inches and struck water. And when they struck water, that made it a conventional system was not going to work. And the system they said that she needed was $28,000, which explained to me why nobody around there had one. So, and I don't know how many people that are watching could go and come up with $28,000 at one time. And you can't go to the bank and get funding for this because they don't have that type of funding available. So we have to change the policies that a lot of the money for a lot of these systems, these wastewater treatment systems, are coming from the federal government. It's coming from either EPA, or if it's in a rural community, it's coming through USDA. And the policies have to be changed. And a lot of the policies that I've seen have been written in such a way that it excludes small communities. And it'll say the only way you can access the funding is that you got to have a town of 10,000 or more people, or a town of 500 or more people. That if they're unincorporated, they're not a town. And most of the United States is actually rural. Most people live in cities, but most of you look, if you go from sea to shining sea, they're rural communities. And I'm hearing about, I don't think that there's a state in the United States that does not have a wastewater problem. And recently I spoke to a group from New York, and a former official was on that, a former government official who dealt with wastewater was happened to be listening in on that webinar and reached out to the organizers to get in touch with me, because one of the other places that she said that has wastewater problems is Puerto Rico. So there are wastewater problems around the country for various reasons, and climate change is actually making it worse. So all of us, if we need to really start looking at this, because this is not just a Flint type issue where people just assume that the only people that are going to be suffering are poor Black people, but ultimately all of us are going to be suffering if we do not develop sustainable infrastructure that address the challenges that are coming with climate change, or that are here with climate change.
Thank you so much. Another question from the audience. What are the general countrywide examples of discrimination in terms of access to sanitation and waste disposal? And are indoor privies the norm everywhere now?
Well, I think for most people, indoor privies are the norm. I answer that question first, and then I answer the second question. Even in mobile homes, I think one of the things that makes the problem worse, they come with the toilet. You know, the toilets work. It's the way once the sewage leaves the toilet, what happens? So we have to come up either with another way to do it through the toilet or coming up with another type of technology that treats it once it leaves the toilet. But in terms of inequities that I've seen, for an example, in Lowndes County, I remember one of the things I recount was an exchange that I had with Senator Warren when I was on a panel that Senator Sanders had pulled together. And she was saying, well, you know, with economic development, because I had complained about the fact that there was public monies was made available to put in place wastewater treatment in one of the little towns in Lowndes County for businesses. And within 10 minutes or less walking from the town hall, we had to step over raw sewage. We were doing our parasite study, but those people were left to their own devices. So we have to stop treating corporations like people, and treating people like they're not even human. And that's part of the problem. That was one of the inequities that I've seen. Then another place where I saw, when I went to Centerville, Centerville is located in Illinois. And I saw more raw sewage on the ground there than I saw in Lowndes County. And most of the areas where I've seen it have been areas where there are people of color. They're either people of color, they're indigenous. If you go to Alaska, there are people in Alaska that never got wastewater infrastructure in the first place because they just never got it, because they were in areas where rural communities that where the government didn't feel the need to do it, or they were indigenous communities. And then those that did get it are starting to have problems with it because of the melting permafrost. So there, in each of these areas, I'm seeing that they're marginalized. They're either people of color or they're poor people. There's a lot of discrimination against poor people, including poor white people. So if you don't believe me, go to West Virginia. Go to Kentucky, go to Tennessee. And I've seen it there as well. So we have to develop another approach where we do not punish people who do not have privilege, or who are out in rural communities with the assumption is that they have to figure it out for themselves or move to a city.
Another question from the audience. Apart from COVID, I wonder if other diseases are spreading as a result of the wastewater issue. If so, what are they? How are people affected? And how are the people and the diseases being treated?
Well, I can't answer all of those questions, but I can answer the questions that I do know the answers to. Well, first of all, we did a parasite study. The one way in which we made this an international got international attention on this was that we partnered with Baylor's National School of Tropical Medicine. And in doing so, we collected fecal, soil, water, and blood samples, and we found evidence of hookworm and other tropical parasites in the people that participated. And it's estimated that at least a third of the people in Lowndes County could potentially have been infected with hookworm or some of these other tropical parasites. We also have another study that has not been published yet, but is going through peer review, where at least where soil samples were collected in 5 states. And those soil samples showed evidence of parasites, intestinal parasites, that were found in those 5 states. Are people being treated for it? Well, first of all, that's why it's America's dirty secret, because doctors are not trained in the US to look for things like this. These are supposedly third world issues. And I guess if they were going to a third world country, they may have, and the doctors that I have met that do know about these issues are doctors that are from those countries. They actually know more about it than American doctors do. So the average doctor, if you went to them complaining, even my own story, when I was bitten by the mosquitoes and broke out on the rash and couldn't figure out what was wrong with me, these mosquitoes had been nesting on a pool of raw sewage. So when I went there, went to my doctor and they ran the blood test, they found nothing. But what I had was the evidence on my body, and even right now on one of my ankles, because I had they ended up doing like a biopsy to try to figure out what it was. I still have a scar there. And clearly it was an indication to me, which is one of the reasons I continue to fight this fight, is that we're not prepared for it. I mean, and COVID is an example of that too, but we're not even prepared for what could currently be here because we're not looking for it. It's not because we're in America, the assumption is we don't have raw sewage on the ground. So we're not looking for the kinds of ailments that are associated with that.
Another question from the audience. Thank you for your work and this challenging talk. Are there NGOs that are remediating the wastewater issue for the impoverished?
You know, when I first started this fight, thank you. When I first started this fight, I actually went and looked to see which NGOs or which foundations were actually doing the type of work to do, you know, to remedy the situation here in the US. And there were none. They were doing it, but they were doing it elsewhere. Again, that's why it's called America's Dirty Secret, because people did not acknowledge or didn't know that this was a problem here in the United States. So, but I think now we're seeing more people that are reaching out, even those that are giving support to us, that would like to see a remedy. So, and one of the things that I like to do with, you know, after receiving the MacArthur Award, is to be able to educate other NGOs, especially people that are on the ground. I think the only way we're gonna have real solutions to this problem is not for somebody to helicopter in and say, oh, I got the greatest contraption ever and we can use that. Cause I've been through that before. I've been doing this for 20 years and people put in systems that fail. And when they fail, especially putting a septic system that fail and it's connected to somebody's toilet in Alabama, it's gonna come back into the house. And that's when they're gonna find another way to have that effluent going somewhere else instead of their homes. So we have to find something that's going to work. And part of that paradigm shift that we like to see is to have the people sitting at the table with the engineers to help them understand what the problem is so they can find some proper ways that actually work for a long term on addressing these issues. Of failed wastewater infrastructure. And of course, one of the things that we do that Kalia alluded to, even when with Jane Fonda and others, is that we actually take people to the area. And when I take them there, I said, look, because some of them will go in and start talking, oh, this is how you fix this. And this, I said, you don't even know what the problem is. You just got here. So basically what I tell people, especially my students, they go to the area, the experts are the people living with the problem. So why don't we get the people that are living with the problem and let them sit down with the engineers and work together on finding a diagram or a paradigm that works. And I think that people that are experiencing the problem should be part of the design concept from design to deployment. Because when we don't do that, people come up with stuff that the community won't accept that they've had failures over and over again.
This is something that you already touched on earlier this evening, but a question from the audience. How is climate change affecting waste management?
Oh, wow, in so many different ways. I can give one example, and I talk about it in the book. In Miami-Dade County, they have lots of issues with failing septic systems because of sea level rise. I remember one of the universities that I'm affiliated with, one of the professors came to me because she said they went to this area and they went to talk about one issue, but the people in that area went to talk about wastewater because they said they had sunny day flooding. And when they look into their, to the water from this flooding, that they could see human feces. This is a problem that that clearly exists in places around the country, but some places more than others because of climate change. And sea level rise is causing failures where people are seeing algae blooms and fish kills. The student that I mentioned earlier, they talked about, who had earned a PhD, one of the communities that he worked in, they had septic tanks and wells. And apparently the septic tanks were contaminating their drinking water. So the more we experience sea level rise, I gave examples of what's happening in Alaska with the melting permafrost. If you have deluges of rain coming down, because rain is part of the equation, and usually when they design a septic system, at least here, they try to look at the water usage in the home, but you can't, how do you measure what the water table is going to do if you have high water tables that are getting higher? Or how do you measure what's going to come out of the sky? Because we don't know, we can't predict when it's going to happen or how much it's going to come down. And that's when people start to see more and more failures. So those are just some of the examples. And I think as it gets warmer, diseases that we generally would have seen just in the South because of the subtropical, you know, nature of the South, they're going to start moving further north. And then that's going to, and the waste problem is going to exacerbate that if we don't find solutions pretty soon.
I'd love to end on a bit of a hopeful note with you. And I wonder if you would talk a little bit about the innovation that you've seen.
I haven't seen the innovation, but we're working on the innovation. One of the things that we like to do in terms of my vision, you know, we can treat wastewater in outer space to drinking water quality. Why can't we do that here? So that's the type of innovation that I would like to see. I really would like for us to work with young people who are out of the box thinkers. I mean, just imagine the fact that, you know, there's COVID has been bad, but one of the good things that I've seen was the global cooperation that took place for the purpose of coming up with a vaccine. Who would have thought that they would have had a vaccine this fast and that could work? So we can use that same ingenuity to try to create something that could that you could go. What I've thought about, what if we could create something like that can treat wastewater in the home, like an HVAC system, and could reuse things that can be reclaimed in this, especially, you know, it could be a part of recycling some of the stuff that's there, because everything in it is not bad. And then the other thing that we've been talking about is that you can actually put sensors in these systems that we envision that can tell us what diseases are there before they become epidemics and pandemics. So that's what I envision. And I think we can arrive there within the next 5 years. And that's what I'm going to be fighting for.
I'm going to end our conversation this evening and saying thank you to both of you. And this just came in from a member of our audience. And I think it's a nice place to end, which is thank you for your brilliant, loving work.
Oh, thank you. That's very encouraging. That's why I keep going. Those kinds of messages. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And thank you all to everyone at home and wherever you are for joining us tonight. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.